We're back in on Canuck Central, hour number two. It's Dan Riccio. I was flying solo for the first hour, but coming in from the bullpen. He's visited every major league ballpark. He's known as our goalie guru here every Wednesday. It's Kevin Woodley in Goal Magazine at NHL.com. What's happening, Woodley?
Not much. I'm coming off the bench, right? Got the backup towel, you know, like how the old days. Got to, you kind of give it that little wrap and then tuck it underneath. I'm backup towel ready to go here.
Yeah. Were you tracking faceoffs in the meantime or what?
Oh, don't get me started on that one. It was a Mike Babcock thing and the number of goaltenders that have played for him. And I know there's other coaches that do it. I think the Vancouver Giants might even do it now. And there's a lot of coaches that, and I get it. Hey, like the principle of keeping the backup goalie engaged by giving him something to do during the game, I get it. And I do think it started with Mike and a lot of his disciples. I know Bill Peters did it in the National Hockey League. But the number of goalies we've talked to at the National Hockey League level, probably most famously Chris Osgood, who absolutely despised that task. And at the NHL level, like, you don't want to have your head down as that puck's flying around, especially when you're on a spot on the bench where you're exposed. Like Ozzie told us a few times while cursing under his breath about the role and about Mike asking him to do it, about how many times he almost got killed out there. So, yeah, you see, you started me off on a sour note here. I was all ready to come in positivity, make a few saves, and you're throwing breakaways at me.
I had no idea that goalies counting faceoffs was going to be such a touchy subject. So we'll leave it there as it is. I know it's been the topic of the hockey world. So before we get into some of the Canucks goalie stuff, do you have a take on the Dreisaitl Matheson exchange?
Oh, does anyone look good in this one? Like, both sides look a little petulant at times. This is the nature of what we've kind of got going in this Zoom environment. I've been on the wrong side of questions that either weren't asked well or weren't received well. I mean, it's funny, we're just kind of speaking of Twitter, and it was obviously a much smaller percentage, but we're at the 8-year anniversary of the Tortorella storming the Calgary Flames locker room. And what a lot of people forget is it was a question I asked in the morning skate that kind of set his whole tone for the day and put his mood in a bad mind frame. And then even after all of that went down, he still had to, in the post game, come back to the question that I asked in the morning and hammer on it before he was even willing to talk about storming the Calgary. So I've been on that side of it. It's not fun. Sometimes it's questions that you don't ask. Sometimes and we've been around this with the Vancouver Canucks, right? Like, mm-hmm. for the first few months of the season, what do you ask? Like, what's left to ask when a team sucks from like an extended period of time? Everyone thinks we enjoy it when things are bad as media members. Like, no, you run out of questions. And so sometimes you might ask the wrong one or push too hard. And I don't know. I just didn't think either side came out looking great on it. And yet I understand, having been there, that these things happen. I guess maybe in the past they just didn't play out the way they do now, where every presser is broadcast to the world and over Zoom. It just didn't used to be that way. You could have that moment in a scrum, and sometimes those were captured too. And sometimes they became somewhat infamous. But I think there was just a lot more personal interaction and the ability to ask questions behind the scenes, especially when it was questions where you're trying to actually get information, which is, it's just hard to get these days in these environments. Like, you can't just pull up next to a guy after the scrum is broken up and have a conversation and ask, hey, like, if I'm seeing this, am I right or am I totally out to lunch? And they could tell you, no, you're an idiot. What are you looking at, without 60 other people watching, or in this case, the entire hockey world?
You talk to goalies all across the league, everywhere. You don't have the opposing goalie coming in and you can go have a chat with them. Like, how much has this changed how you get touch points and get intel from goalies around the league?
It's changed it in a like massively negative way. And I don't mean that to be a complaint, right? Because I'm blessed to do my job, right?
Yeah.
And I understand we're in a pandemic and this is just the reality. But the other part of that reality is that interaction, that's what fuels story ideas. Marcus Nasman, I used to drive him nuts probably as much as I do, you know, Chris Faber when I talk about goaltending. Like, because I was always asking questions about his shot, about when he changed sticks or how he taped his stick. Or this is sort of before I got into goalie specialization, so to speak. And because I always saw it as my idea to try and go into that locker room. My idea of the job was to try and go into that locker room and ask the questions that and sort of get some of the answers that maybe fans wanted, right? Like details, information. I'm kind of a detail geek, and those are the types of things I wanted to know about so that I could relay it, whether it's because I used to work on a pregame show or, you know, just for an article. And those were, that's where you got the ideas. You know, what made Naslin's shot so deceptive back in his heyday from a shooter and goalie perspective? You got the ideas by talking to the guys, as opposed to go on Zoom. You almost have to have an idea. You can't have a conversation. You have to almost have an idea of what your story is, and you ask a question to get quotes to fill in the blanks in your story. And I miss being able to have the conversations that lead to ideas that generate new stories and new conversations that I can then have around the league. Now, I am somewhat blessed, privileged to have contacts for a lot of these guys, having built them up over the years. So I can text guys and ask them. But again, you don't go on that, I don't want to call it a fishing expedition, but you're less likely to sort of just have that general conversation to find ideas, you know, sitting at the locker after a skate for 5 minutes. If you're texting them, you're, again, you're more likely, I've got this idea, what do you think of it? Can I grab a quote or two if you agree? As opposed to just sort of picking their brains and learning from them the way we used to. And I miss that. I miss that a lot. Not just goalies. I miss that with, like, Elias Pettersson this year. Like, yeah. We didn't, you know, when we went back to the stick question, it was me and Patrick Johnson. I noticed that it had been like almost 3 weeks since he changed the stick. You didn't want to make a big deal of it, because then you know what happened. And as a matter of fact, the day we asked for him, I sort of just wanted to ask him one question in the hallway, not have that play out on the Zoom podium, because you saw the response. People actually said and responded to us posting on social media about him talking about his stick. People were like, oh, he's complaining, like, you know, poor, you know, it's a poor craftsman that blamed. Like, they attacked Pettersson for answering our questions about something that we had noticed and found fascinating and wondered. He didn't blame his sticks. He didn't cry or whine about having the wrong batch. He just explained to us what had happened and why, you know, this elite player had to change sticks a couple of times during the season, why he was using last year's sticks. And again, I think a lot of that context goes missing, the ability to have that conversation behind the scenes. It's funny, I've heard a lot of stuff about him getting knocked off the puck, and yet I've seen photos where it looks to me like he's a guy that's put on some pounds and put on some muscle in the offseason. And as we know from other players in the past, sometimes that affects your hands, how you shoot, it affects your biomechanics. You know, that's the conversation you'd like to have. But the world we live in right now with Zoom access, it's just a lot harder to get those things, you know, quietly behind the scenes, especially when you're wrong. You don't want to ask a question where you're just trying to figure out, you know, am I right here? Am I seeing the right thing? And if you do it on that Zoom thing, it can feel like you're putting them on the spot. But we don't want to put them on the spot either. We want to get information, but not in a way, if the answer isn't what we expect, that makes them look bad. That's not the intent. It's never the intent. And it's harder to sort of find that line and find that balance when we're not in the room. And that's why I look so forward to hopefully one day getting back there.
Yeah, it's so much about getting that background info to help you tell the story. And, you know, it's just it's hard to get that in the Zoom world. We're an hour with the goalie guru here on Canuck Central. It's Kevin Woodley. So Bruce Boudreau has asked his biggest takeaway from the road trip last night after the Canucks had just beaten the Nashville Predators and Washington Capitals. And his immediate reaction is, we've got a great goalie. It's like, thanks, Bruce. I think we knew that already. But I did come away pretty impressed with how the team, you know, played really in the overall against, you know, five big time teams, Kevin. Like, do the numbers back up how I felt the Canucks played?
Well, let's just say that answer from Bruce last night was very appropriate, because despite a lot of the zone time that we saw the Canucks do, and there were some Sedin-like moments, right, where especially that Pettersson line with Hoglander and Pod Colson were, you know, cycling and controlling play and extended zone time. And I'm not saying any of those things are negatives. Those are all positive. But at the end of the night, the Canucks generated 4 high percentage chances when I look at the numbers on ClearSight Analytics, and the Nashville Predators generated 11. So last night was a night where the Vancouver Canucks won a game because they had the better goalie. I actually thought David Rittich, and that said, I thought David Rittich was really good last night until the third goal. But that was a night where the Nashville Predators expected goals was a little over 3.5, and they only got 1. And the Canucks managed 3 and barely got to, 2.72 with their expected goals. Like, they got outplayed last night. I'm not sure watching that game, because of the zone time and because of some of those sort of extended shifts in the Nashville zone, that a lot of people would have expected those numbers this morning. But that's where I love the ability to look at it through this lens, because it really sort of objectifies it.
It didn't feel as tilted as you talk about, though. Like, honestly, like, thinking back, it doesn't feel as tilted as you talk about, as you mentioned there with the numbers.
In terms of in Nashville's favor?
Yeah.
And a lot of it was counterpunch chances and, breakaways tend to rack up the expected goals and things like that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Sometimes that's hard to measure, and that's why I like these things to measure. Now, that said, that was the Nashville game. The Washington game, the Capitals slightly outplayed them, and Demko was again – notably the better goaltender. Florida, Vancouver was the better team and they got out goalied. Tampa Bay, they outplayed them and got out goalied. Carolina, they were badly outplayed and they got slightly out goalied, but it didn't matter because they were so badly outplayed. So the irony is, I'd love to have, I guess we will see when Florida comes to town, love to have seen that Florida game with Demko on top of his game, because I thought, I thought they were the better team early in the trip, and then they had to lean more heavily on Thatcher Demko later in it, and he was ready.
It's something that popped up in the two games, Nashville and Washington. They both end up being wins. In the second period, there was a lot of those counterpunch chances where Canucks would have zone time, but there would be a breakdown and off goes an opportunity the other way. We saw a couple of breakaways, some 3-on-1s, 2-on-1s, that, the opposition just wasn't able to finish. And it just was like kind of weird, because the Canucks had been pretty strong structurally, at least for the most part, especially through the early part of the trip, as you mentioned there, but they just had some really ugly breakdowns in the last two games.
Yeah, interesting that it's the second period, because I just toggled over, and sure enough, in the second period, I talked about Nashville having 11 high percentage chances in that game, which is a really high number. 6 did come in the second period. Yeah. So there's where your eyes are matching what the numbers are saying, Dan. Second period has, for a number of years, been a problem. I think that you can chalk that up a little bit to weariness and on the road and the difficulty of that long change. And that's where you're more likely to get caught in transition and things like that. Kind of same with the Washington game. 5 of their 7 high percentage chances were in the second period. So that's a good note by you, a good sort of good eyes by you. And in terms of the reasons, we think of that Washington game, that second end of back-to-back. By the time they get to Nashville, it's 3-4 and 4-6 and all those things. And you wonder if sort of that combination of long change, tired bodies and tired minds, maybe making mistakes in that context might lead to some of those breakdowns, some of those odd man rushes. And the good news is they've got that guy that sent it to the All-Star game, at the back end of that. And those types of chances are where Thatcher Demko has excelled the most this year. When I look at his numbers and his statistics on the season, we've talked about it before, one of the best goalies in the league when it comes to breakaways this season, one of the best goalies in the league when it comes to slot line plays and rush chances this season. And so in some ways, taking those types of chances offensively, like they do more under Bruce Boudreau, knowing that they're going to give that up the other way. And again, we've talked about that too. Like, this is a team that, for all the improvements they've made under Bruce, they've actually gotten worse in terms of the amount of rush chances they give up. And yet, when your goalie, that's one of his strengths, like when your goalie's one of the best goalies in the league on odd man rushes and breakaways, maybe that isn't a bad thing. As much as I think that's a tough way to win, especially come playoff time, you know, at the very least, you're playing to the strengths. You're creating more offense for your team, and you're playing to the strengths of a goaltender who has the ability to bail you out on those.
Yeah, it gives you a bit more of a margin for error. There was a lot of two-on-ones. The Canucks had some. You know, they gave up some. Of all the ones, I think Nechas was the only one to score on the two-on-one Saturday for Carolina on Demko. He took the shot. Now, I don't know, like, every time I saw it, the Canucks especially, they had a few two-on-ones the last few games, and they're always taking the shot. Even Podkolzin went over the net last night when him and Hoglander ended up on a two-on-one. I mean, it's got to be common knowledge. Like, you got to try and make and find the pass any which way you can, no?
I don't know how common knowledge it is, and I do think around the league, and actually I thought this was one of the reasons we saw save percentage around the league go up early in the year. You know, I think, Dan, that sometimes we get into that shot mentality, and we've certainly heard it from Bruce Boudreau a lot. Like, he wants shots. We've heard the players talk about it. Like, he stresses shots. And I don't know how much they would tell a player what to do on an odd man rush, but I can tell you that completing a pass across the middle of the ice on an odd man rush increases your chances of scoring, like, significantly. We will see an odd man rush. And if the player keeps and just heads in a straight line towards the net, even though he gets pretty close, and we think of that as a grade A chance, a lot of the times it's actually a low percentage scoring chance if it's a straight line and there's no pass. That same 2-on-1 or 3-on-2, if you can make a pass across the slot line and get a shot off, you go to 30 or 40% depending on where you are on the ice. Like, it goes, your chances of scoring increase by 3 or 4 times. And now there are other factors. The defense on the other teams have figured this out. They're trying to prevent that pass. But sometimes when I watch their spacing, when I watch the way they settle, they sort of stay in straight lines and stay in straight lanes. And frankly, sometimes it's the guy on the other end who would be receiving the pass, sort of not changing whether it's his pace or his angle or his line enough to create a lane for the guy with the puck to hopefully get a pass across. At the end of the day, I end up banging my head against the wall the number of times they shoot on odd man rushes rather than trying to make that play. And no, I get it. It looks to the naked eye, it's like, if you miss the pass and you don't get a shot, it's like, oh my God, they didn't get anything out of that. 2-on-1 and no shot. Like, that's a cardinal sin. Well, the low percentage shot, like, if you get 4 2-on-1s and you try 4 low percentage shots, you got a 40% of a goal on that. You complete one pass out of those 4 and you got 40% on that shot alone. Complete 3 and you've got, you know, 0.8 of a goal. Like, the math adds up. The Washington Capitals won a Stanley Cup specifically doing this. Go back and watch the Stanley Cup final between the Capitals and the Vegas Golden Knights. Watch how many times guys like Ovechkin and some of their biggest names passed out of 2-on-1 to the point where I knew it was the strategy. Because they had trusted their goalie coach to sort of help dictate how they created offense. And I still couldn't believe it, but it worked. Now, it helps when it's Ovechkin and Backstrom and names like that making passes on your odd man rushes and being on the other ends of those passes. It's nice when it's skilled guys making those plays. But the reality was they understood that the odds of scoring went up 3 or 4 times if they made that pass. And so, yeah, every time I see the Canucks hold on a odd man rush, a little part of me dies. It's usually the part that's associated with my forehead because I'm slamming it into the wall.
It really got frustrating towards the end of the trip, the amount of 2-on-1s that they had, and they shot, I think, on all of them. But you mentioned, okay, they're taught to defend the pass and, how does a goalie play a 2-on-1?
Well, I think it all depends a lot on sort of how the team, like, obviously not all 2-on-1s are created the same.
Yes.
And so, and this has actually been one of the most fascinating parts of, at Ingle Magazine, we do something every week called Pro Reads. It was one of my, I don't have very many good ideas, Dan, but this was one of them. And essentially, it is we sit down and do a video session with an NHL goalie. And so we bank as guys come through town. And again, this is another thing that's become harder during the pandemic. But I did one with Braden Holtby this year. I did one with Elvis Merzlikens when he came through town. You sit down, you pick out like 8 clips, hopefully you find 5 they like, and you have them walk you through what they're seeing. And so there are so many factors. Is the guy with the puck on his forehand or backhand? Is he on a strong or weak side? Is the guy who's going to receive the pass, has he got a one-time option, or does he have to have that puck come across his body? Like, every little piece of information in terms of the type of attack and the players attacking, who it is, what their tendencies are, this all factors into how a goaltender plays it. But one of the most fascinating parts of the Pro Reads experience, and we're over 2 years into this, so like if you're a member of, you know, shameless plug of In Goal Premium, you can go in right now and watch well over 100 of these, like we're like up to 110 video review sessions with Carey Price, Carter Hart, Frederick Anderson, all, you know, some of the biggest names in the game explaining these things. And the part that's jumped out to me the most is for all the details they pick up in real time at full speed in terms of what the attackers are doing, how much of their decision-making process as an NHL goaltender is based on what their defensemen within the system are expected to do, whether they read them executing it properly, and how much they trust them to do it. Like, it really is a massive part of how a goaltender plays every situation, and a two-on-one is no exception. Now, we see a lot more teams try and force that play at the blue line, which affects you. You're more likely to end up possibly with a breakaway. Some goalies, some teams prefer that. The one that I found interesting from Holtby, we were breaking down a really in-tight save he made with the Dallas Stars, like a bang-bang backdoor play off of an odd man rush. And he said, I want my defenseman, like if he's going to let that pass across, I want him to wait and then force late, like either force a shot or force a pass later, deeper into the zone. And it's counterintuitive, right? I'm thinking, well, don't you want that pass to happen earlier so you can read it early, get across, get set, get square? And his thought was, no, I want if it, the closer it is to me, the less time that guy has to do anything with it when he receives it. So if that passes to the top of the crease on a backdoor one touch and I push across, like, he doesn't have the ability at that rate, at that spot. All he's doing is redirecting it at net. All I've got to do is get that space, build my coverage from the, you know, pad along the ice, you know, glove over top of it, try and stay over top of my legs as I come across, not spread out, but build that coverage from the ice up. If you make that pass into the high slot, now I've got to get across on my feet and read. You know, he could shoot, and when you shoot, you could shoot anywhere. It's why goalies, for the most part, try and force a deke on a breakaway, because a deke only goes left or right. Shot could go high glove, low glove, five hole, by your ear, blocker, high, low. Like, a shot can go anywhere, but a deke goes left or right. All you got to do is read it and stay on it and make that push once you've determined which direction he's going. So by the similar token, you know, here's Braden explaining to me how he wants that pass on a two-on-one or a three-on-two to be really tight, because the guy doesn't have any time to do anything with that puck and his options are so much more limited. So those are the types of preferences that often play out between a goaltender and his defenseman. And sometimes they're within, you know, the context of the system and what the coach wants will override it. But all those factors sort of matter when you're assessing a play. And it becomes a fascinating conversation to sort of learn that and figure that out and see how these guys like, and it's never the same from one guy to the next. So right. There's no absolute right answer. It's what I love about the position. There's no absolute one way to play it. But I think it would surprise people how much defensemen and what they do affects what the goalie's going to do as a result. And some of those preferences, again, like Holtby's, can be a little counterintuitive. Now, the key is, having said all that and taking a deep breath, you're getting a lot of rest here, Dan, during this hour. The key now is, how do I go to school on that as an offensive player? Yeah. But not just from an individual goalie perspective, but, you know, in general, if this is what they want, how do we give them something different? And I think, you know, the numbers tell us part of this, the success of passing out of a two-on-one versus keeping and shooting, taking it from a low percentage chance on a shot to a high percentage chance by making a play. Like, these are all the factors that need to go in how you create offense in the National Hockey League. The other part, low-high plays, right? We've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I love the fact the Canucks are finally using plays from the goal below the goal line. As a goalie, intuitively, it forces me to turn my head. I can't see what's in front of me because I'm looking behind me. I don't know where players are moving around the zone. My defensemen are doing the same thing. They're watching the puck behind the goal line. They can't see where guys are moving behind them around the zone. It makes things harder. From a goalie perspective, it makes things harder. Those are things you should try and do offensively, because that's a good thing if you're making the other goalie's life harder.
Yeah, more things to worry about, more holes to try and cover up would be the problem there for the goalie. We love it. We're going to keep it going. Demko's workload, how the Canucks goalie depth chart is shaping up, and more to come as we continue this hour with the goalie guru, Kevin Woodley, on Canucks Central. It's Canucks Central. Dan Riccio here with you. Satyar Shah will be back tomorrow. Chris Gear is going to join us, former AGM with the Vancouver Canucks. He is slated to join us in the second hour of the program. You can always subscribe to the podcast. That way you never miss any of our exclusive interviews or any edition of Canucks Central or any post-game show either. This hour we have In Goal Magazine and NHL.com's goalie guru. It's Kevin Woodley, and so far, mostly positive feedback on the Dunbar Lumber text line, Kevin. So people haven't got tired of hearing you go off about the goalie union just yet.
We're only halfway through. Give it time. And you know, do you realize that Sean Shapiro is coming up after me, and he is also a goaltender. But so slowly but surely, we are planning our takeover of the world here.
I did not know that. I'm going to have to get Sean's take on some of this as well. So, you know, Demko ends up having to play every game of the road trip here, and he got better as it went along. You know, they even Saturday, you know, he wasn't expecting to play, ended up getting a full practice in, and then having to play that game because Jaro Halak ends up into COVID protocol. Is there a point where you worry or wonder about Demko's workload and how heavy it's been?
Hey, listen, and I've seen what those hours with Ian Clark look like when Thatcher Demko thinks he's not playing. And, like, wow. Like, wow, to be able to come and play that night and then play the next day after an hour like that, like, it just tells you what kind of condition and what, and not that that's a surprise to anyone, but yeah, I guess you did, like, of course you worry. Like, this is not ideal. There was a reason they had Jaroslav Halak scheduled to play that game. But you can't really worry about it because you don't have a lot of alternatives. Unless you see a decline in play over time. And they've got a few days here as they come back to Vancouver before the game on Friday. But until you see a decline that you think is based on him wearing down. And I've used this sort of example over the years, whether it was Markstrom here or Demko under Ian Clark. You know, he has that ability. And in the past, it's been a decline based on, hey, like, you're so busy resting and managing your rest that you lose the time to manage your game. You lose those 1 hour sessions with a goalie coach to stay sharp. And usually as that starts to compile and you start to see a decline in play, Ian was really good at knowing and recognizing that. And Travis Green was really good at listening when Ian said, we need to give him a day off, whether it was Markstrom or Demko. We need the other guy to play so we can get him back to 100%. So you would see that sort of diminishing returns I always use as his level of play dropped off. And until you see that, yeah, you're concerned about it, but I don't know you do anything about it because you don't really have a choice, right? Like, this is crunch time. And yet, you know, you have to trust him to be honest with you. This is one thing Jacob would play through anything, but sometimes that becomes a negative because you play through minor things to the point they become long-term and they can't afford long-term. So that's the other part you've got to be cognizant of. If there's something small and nagging that could build up, Thatcher's got to be honest with them, and they have to be honest in their assessment about, hey, like, if we play him tonight, could we be without him for 2 weeks? And until you get Jaroslav Halak back and his experience, and he's been really good when he's been in, that's something you don't want to risk. But in the meantime, without those signs, like, he's back to the guy we saw in December in terms of feeling his rhythm and his timing the last couple of games of that trip. And you just roll him out there as often as you need to. And like I said, the big question to me is when Jaroslav Halak is going to be back. Because again, he's played really well for them. And for all this talk I've heard of trading him, man, if you're serious about trying to make a run of the playoffs, as much as I'm a fan of where Spencer Martin has come this year in his game, and I've always been a fan of Michael DiPietro and the work he's done over the past couple of years, like, there's a reason you got Yaroslav Halak, and this schedule is going to be a beast, especially after what was supposed to be the Olympic break. I actually don't mind their February, but everybody was facing this coming out of the Olympic break, and you're going to need more than one guy. And the level that Yaro's played at when he's gotten the opportunity to be in there, you're going to need that down the stretch.
Canucks have back-to-backs end of January, 31st and the 1st. They're in Chicago and then Nashville. New schedule announced today. They'll play Arizona and the Islanders on February 8th and 9th. So not a ton of back-to-backs in their schedule, but they should have, in theory, we don't know for sure, they should have Yaroslav Halak back, they hope, by the Calgary game, which would be next Saturday, the 29th, back up from south of the border. Now, is that part of the reason why it seems very unlikely the Canucks, I mean, Halak holds the cards with the no-move clause, but also, it feels like while they're still hovering in this playoff race, how can you trade Yaroslav Halak if you don't have confidence in a Spencer Martin or anybody else to fill that role?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's even that you don't have confidence. They haven't had the opportunity, right? There's uncertainty there. It's been a while for Spencer, and as good as he's looked in the American Hockey League, that's why they got Halak. He gives you that confidence because he's been in this situation before. I mean, this is a guy in Yaroslav Halak who, you know, at times over the past couple of years has pushed Tuukka Rask, a first ballot Hall of Famer, for starts in Boston. Like, he's a good goaltender. And this has been a really tough season for him to find rhythm and timing. I loved that in the midst of their winning streak, they went to him rather than just riding Demko, because it showed, like, hey, that they believe that there is that reason, that there is that trust, that they believe in him, and they went to him, and he delivered, and he's kind of delivered all year. So there's been times where you can see that lack of sort of timing and rhythm and comfort level in games early on, but he, for the most part, and his adjusted numbers, you know, bear this out, he's been really, really good in a tough spot. I can't speak to what his thoughts are on potentially being traded. I can't remember where I saw it, but I know someone sort of said they would be disappointed, or wrote they'd be disappointed if Yaroslav Halak wouldn't want. And this is when things were going poorly and it didn't look like they'd be a playoff team. If he wouldn't want to go to a contending team, should that option present itself? You know, I know a lot of people speculated Edmonton. Well, at this point, are they any more of a contending team than the Vancouver Canucks? So I haven't talked to Yaroslav about this, but the biggest thing I would say is, like, when people make that statement about being a professional and things like that, like, this is a guy who has sort of earned his place and his spot here. They wanted him to be a part of this. They structured the contract the way it was, including the no move, in order to get what was the best option in that age window that allowed them to split the contract this way. The cost of that was a no move. This is a guy who's been around the league a long time, who has a young family that's here in Vancouver and settled. And so if he doesn't want to move and they have a chance to make the playoffs and he sees himself being a part of that, I know the fan base might not want to hear it because they don't want the cap hit next year and they want to recoup an asset, but 100% he's got that right. And he's earned that right. And that was part of why you had to grant him this to get him, because he would have had other options. Like, Yaroslav Halak has been a guy who has been more than just a backup for a number of years here. He has been one of those, you know, high-end 1Bs. And even though he hasn't gotten that opportunity here, and, you know, probably less opportunity than they would have expected coming in, I would guess, he still played at that level. And so I don't have any problem if that's the way he decides to go. And again, that's not any information on my part. That's just knowing what the background is, and not knowing whether he's made a decision or whether they've even come to him on those kind of things.
So, Spencer Martin, you mentioned how he has really, like, earned all he's been getting this year, played really well in Abbotsford, and has done a lot of what they've asked of him, you know, and I think people kind of look at it and are like, well, why aren't they really giving DiPietro those games and sort of that, you know, ongoing conversation of you give the younger guy and the guy that you expect to be the goalie of the future the more starts. But I think that does a disservice to how much work Spencer Martin has put in.
Yeah, and hey, listen, there's truth to both sides of that, right? Like, you do need, especially after last year, you do need Michael DiPietro to play, but you got to earn it too, right? And it just feels like it's never gotten on a roll for him this year in Abbotsford. I can be honest with you, like, you know, like, I'd almost defer to Chris Faber on goaltending, which is, you know, I mean, it just sounds absurd. Chris, don't get, like, I can't believe I just said that, but he knows that situation better. I'm just kidding, Faves. He knows that team better. He knows that situation better. Like, it just feels like there, whether it's injuries or illness, he's just never gotten on a roll there up until this last weekend. So it's not like you stop believing in Michael DiPietro's potential, but you know, when you got a guy that works as hard as Spencer has and earns that opportunity, you also have to respect that. Like, that, that matters. You can't just ignore it completely. And, you know, there's a goalie there. And I know they saw that, and maybe the expectation was that he was fifth on the depth chart coming in. But, you know, I know Curtis Sanford saw the work he was putting in and saw how hard he was working to try and adapt to a lot of new concepts here. And this is a goalie who made changes when he was in Tampa Bay, sort of changed how he managed his depth with the goalie coaches of the Lightning, and was in a tough role in the on the taxi squad there, but did everything that was asked of him. And he comes here and, you know, he really seems to have embraced their three-stance system that Ian Clark preaches and that Curtis Sanford coaches with the American League team. Talking to Spencer, actually, the night we talked to him, he's on the taxi squad. He woke up the next morning. We had him on as a podcast guest. The next morning, he woke up and he was the backup. That was when Yaroslav tested positive. But he talked about, you know, how he used to play almost in his save stance. Imagine if you're watching a goalie, the save stance is sort of that flexed and ready and sort of almost loaded like a spring to sort of react to pucks. And he played every time the puck was in the zone, like he spent a lot of time in his save stance. And when the play's on the perimeter, you'll see this with Demko. You see it not so much with Halak. They haven't made those changes because, frankly, he's had so much success in his career they didn't feel like they needed to. But when you watch Markstrom, watch Demko, when the play's on the perimeter, they've got their feet close together. They're narrow. Think of making a T-push as a skater. It's the same as a goalie. If my feet are closer together when I start that push, I have more extension in my push leg. I can generate more power. I can move easier. Expend less energy. I'm a lot more sort of efficient and powerful moving around my crease. As the play gets closer and we get lower and wider as a goaltender, closer into that sort of save reaction, that sort of wound up like a spring stance, it gets harder to move. You can get a little stuck. It requires a lot more energy to imagine if you're, again, if you're making that T push, now your push leg is further out from you. So you don't have as much extension. You can't generate as much power, but also, because your edges, not quite, you don't want them dug into the ice, but they get a little, as you widen out, they dig into the ice a little more. Well, if I'm pushing left in a T push, I've got to disengage that left skate first. And that's a lot easier when I'm narrow and tall in my stance and upright. And so there's a lot of value there, but this is a guy in Spencer Martin, his seventh year pro, in his first 6 years, nobody'd sort of showed him that, like that concept. It's not for every goalie, but it's one they preach quite adamantly here. And it's one he's embraced, but it's not a snap of the fingers change to make. And he's worked really hard at it. And so you can see the positive effects it's had on his game. Now, sometimes we see goalies like Jordan Binnington, who they get a new coach and a new voice. Charlie Lindgren this year with St. Louis Blues, 5 games. He didn't even get a shot with Montreal last year, Charlie Lindgren. Like, he's on their taxi squad the whole year, was one of the few guys that never got into a game. 6 years in Montreal, 24 games. He goes to St. Louis this year. Yeah, he's back in the A right now, but when Binnington had COVID, he played 5 games. He won all 5. I think he had a shutout in there, and he had a .958 save percentage. And is that just a small sample with a guy on a new team? Yeah, maybe some of it is that. But talking to him again last week, he talked about how there were things he's unlocked and doing differently in St. Louis, actually off rushes and stance related, that have really helped him. And so, is Spencer Martin the next Jordan Binnington? Is Charlie Lindgren the next Jordan Binnington? I'm not saying either of these guys is going to get into an NHL game and lead their team to the Stanley Cup. What I am saying is there's a reason we have those cliches about goalies taking longer. And sometimes it's that different voices at different stages in their career, they get all these different concepts, and it takes a while to either hit a stage where you're willing to listen to them. That was the case of Jacob Markstrom. Or the stage where, you know, sort of when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Like sometimes it's a combination of all those things, a new concept, something clicks with you that you maybe, even if you were shown before, you didn't think of it in the same way. Like these kind of things happen for goaltenders. And so, you know, that's why we get that cliche. And that's why, as much as I'm not saying, you know, that Spencer Martin is going to be that guy, I don't think he can be completely dismissive of it either. You know, if you need him, let's see what he can do. And with the work he put in at the beginning of the season, he earned the opportunity in the A. And I'd like to think if he gets the opportunity here, and he may not, but if he does, that that work will continue to pay off.
We think about, you know, goalies, and I know we've talked about this in the past, but, you know, the different voices, but, you know, different systems can help goalies too, can it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and sometimes it's, at the end of the day, like, you know, I always say goaltending never exists in a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, like systems play matters, but sometimes reach that goes beyond just good D, bad D, right? Like at the end of the day, everybody wants to be behind a good defensive team, like goalie friendly environments. Yay. You know, give me one of those every time. But sometimes they don't fit, right? Like Torts in Vancouver, just to use it as an example, like he created a pretty good goaltender environment. He did in Columbus as well, like New York as well. But the goaltending environment was not good for Roberto Luongo. Roberto Luongo was a spot-to-spot end zone goaltender who relied a lot on exceptional instincts and read and react ability. Well, when you drop everybody into the house and clog the front of the net and create a lot of sort of pucks off legs and broken plays for a goaltender who liked to be up at the top of his crease and making those reads, and now he can't see the puck. And a big goaltender with size 13 skates that, you know, sometimes turning those things were like turning a battleship, like skating was not his strength. And now all of a sudden he can't read the play. Pucks are bouncing off legs in every which direction and lateral recovery speed is not his strength. Like it wasn't necessarily a bad defensive environment. I'm sure if I don't have the archives, like ClearSight didn't exist back then. So I can't go look up what the expected save percentage was like I could now, but I bet you it would have said it was a goalie friendly environment. But I can tell you, it sure as hell didn't fit Roberto Luongo. It was like when the Canucks used to sort of trade rush chances or become a rush team when Roberto was here. Like, yeah, every goalie can play rush chances. Every goalie can play end zone chances. Roberto's strength was end zone. Like rush, it's not so much that it was a weakness. It's just you weren't playing to his strength. Kind of like we talked about with Demko, right? And so environment matters, and it's not as simple as good defensive environment applies the same to every goaltender. You know, I look at the success that the Minnesota Wild have had with Cam Talbot since signing him, and I think a lot of that is they actually did the work with ClearSight Analytics and sort of mapped out where Cam's strengths and weaknesses were as a goaltender statistically on all these different types of chances and plays, and saw a profile that fit almost perfectly with what they gave up and what they didn't give up as a team in Minnesota. Now, the challenge, of course, is they've changed coaches since then, and that changes as well. And Cam's had to adjust. But, you know, you can do that work. You can find those fits using analytics. And then the other part is that you don't know is, you know, Demko's adjusting right now. Sometimes fewer shots. Yeah, hey, I want less shots as a goaltender. Yeah, instinctively that makes sense. But it does affect your rhythm. It does affect your timing. We've seen the Canucks spend those long periods of time in the other end that we didn't see earlier in the season, like they did in Nashville the other night. But then, as you said, give up an odd man rush or give up a breakaway. Man, that's tough as a goaltender mentally. And there are guys historically great goaltenders. Curtis Joseph should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. But he couldn't manage. Like, he was great in Edmonton. Throw 70 shots at him, and he was one of the best in the world. He goes to Detroit where the expectations are the same and the expectations were different, but he didn't face the same amount of shots. He wasn't busy and he wasn't the same goaltender. And that's an adjustment that Demko's having to make right now with Vancouver. And something that's really impressed me is his ability to sort of not let that type of environment where your team's sort of skating around the other end for long periods of time between shots that you face. He hasn't let that affect him negatively so far.
All right, so we're running out of time, but there's a couple of things.
What do we get? Like four? I got through an hour on four questions.
Pretty much. But people are loving it. The Dunbar Lumber text line is absolutely loving it right now. And we like to hear that. Woodley joins us every Wednesday here on Canuck Central. Who should Edmonton go after? Elliot Friedman mentioning today that they're finally fed up. They need to go get a goalie after, you know, what happened over the weekend. Injuries again to Mike Smith, not trusting Mikko Koskinen. And now they are just pushing, a little bit of the panic button and saying, we have to get a goalie in here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Listen, Koskinen has been fine for them in a backup 1B role, but every time you've needed more out of him, it's been the low percentage goals that kill him. I honestly believe that Stuart Skinner is a National Hockey League goalie, that he's made that step, that he's ready to be an NHL goalie. But asking him to carry a subpar defensive team, like, that's the other thing. Like, there aren't many goalies that can fix that problem because they're not a good team. Mm-hmm. They're middle of the pack. They're not as bad. Like, they're actually better than Vancouver defensively by the metrics, but not by much. And so they're not a team that I look at and go, well, when I see this, this is playoff success written all over it. You're just a goalie away. Like, they're going to need elite top 10 goaltending to get into the playoffs. It's what they got out of Mike Smith last year and why they got into the playoffs. Like, Mike Smith was a top 10 adjusted goaltender last year. And, I actually didn't mind the bet. You know, Randeep's got one on me here, right? Remember, I argued with him in the preseason. I said that I like Mike Smith to repeat, and I still do if he could stay healthy. The problem is his birth certificate says that's going to be unlikely, and it hasn't happened so far. So how do you fix it? I'll be honest with you. You know, I look at guys like Charlie Lindgren. Could they be the next Bennington? Yeah, you could take those risks. But the only guy that you could actually say, like, slam dunk gives you a chance to provide that top 10 level goaltending, and has a track record actually as recently as last season, is one of the few guys to take a bottom third defensive team in the metrics that I trust for playoff success and actually get them through a round, is Marc-Andre Fleury. Vegas was not a good defensive team last year. He was full value for that Vezina trophy, and he's showing again what he can do in Chicago after a rough start. But does he want to go to Edmonton? His family settled in Chicago. He barely wanted to leave Vegas to go there. I don't have those answers, but the list of guys who can actually fix a problem as big as the Oilers defensively are is really short. Your easiest bet is that Mike Smith gets healthy and can find the rhythm and form that he had last year. Short of that, you know, it's a pretty short list of guys that can go in there and carry a team that is that middling defensively to the type of success that market seems to think that team's capable of because of two players. I don't know why you make that bet and would give up a ton of assets when maybe the goal, you know, fixing the goaltending is asking the wrong question, but it certainly, you could get improvements in goal. I just think there's only one that's a big enough improvement, and that's a name that's not going to be easy to land. It's going to cost you a lot of futures.
Last thing, I promise. But the people want to know the goalie guru's take on the Whitecaps trading Maxime Crépeau. Okay, no, that's more my expertise. I can't figure out why the Whitecaps did that. Honestly, what are they thinking? That's all I got to say about that.
Listen, you can't right at the end too. Like, at the end of the conversation, you're going to introduce soccer goaltending. Do you know what? Have you seen? You know, listen, for you, the size of those nets. Are you kidding me?
It's a lot of ground to cover.
Oh, I'm going to have nightmares now, Reach. All right. I'm going to have nightmares.
We'll figure it out. Woodley, this was awesome. Really appreciate it, man. We'll do it again next week. Well, maybe not the full hour, but the regular time.
Listen, you got the goalie union taking over here. If the people want a full hour, we'll give them a full hour.
All right. Thanks for this, Woodley. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. I had fun, buddy.
There is Kevin Woodley, In Goal Magazine, NHL.com, at Kevin is in goal. Brilliant. Makes the hour easy on me, for sure. But so much good info and so much on the inside of the position and how the pros read the game and how they develop their games as well. It is Canuck Central. Up next, the business of the NHL. Sean Shapiro will be joining us and his take on how the NHL is rescheduling games and what it may mean for the future of the league. That's next on Canuck Central. the final hour of Canuck Central. I just want to say, I'm happy to have bridged the gap. I don't know if you all were here for hour one of Canuck Central, but we had Ian McIntyre on the show, and I asked him about Eddie Lack's beef with an article he wrote back in 2016, and iMac shared that he was also unhappy with how Eddie Lack felt about it. But over the last hour, Eddie Lack has come out on Twitter, at Eddie Lack, our favorite former Canuck goalie and yours, and mentioned that he and iMac had a long discussion together. They chatted over the phone. They hashed out their beef. And while they both still, you know, are upset that this happened to some extent, they both at least see each other's side a little bit clearer. And Eddie even went as far as to apologize to Ian for making assumptions about ties with upper management, and that he was told to write the things that he wrote. But Eddie still firm in that he didn't love what he read in the article, and he's entitled to that. So we're happy to have bridged the gap here between Eddie Lack and Ian McIntyre, as reporter and player beefs are just ruling the day in the National Hockey League these days. Our next guest is covering the business of the NHL at The Athletic, covered the Dallas Stars for a long time, and as I understand from my previous guest, Kevin Woodley, you play goalie as well, Sean. Am I correct on this?
Yes. Proud member of, not nearly as accomplished as many, but as some of your other guests, but proud member of the union, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if Kevin's ever seen you play, but I'm going to guess the book on you is High Glove. Am I right on that?
Oh, I like the, I've been known to try to be way too aggressive with the poke check, so that happens a lot.
Fair enough. I'll keep that in mind if we ever end up in some kind of weird media game at an NHL Winter Classic or something. Who knows?
Sounds good.
Sean Shapiro, our guest here on Canucks Central. Yeah, we've seen the new schedule come out for the NHL today, and they've made some adjustments to how they will be testing players. As we know, asymptomatic players will not have to be tested unless they are crossing the border at this point after the All-Star break. So, you know, the NHL continuing to try and make life easier while they play through the pandemic. But I don't feel they expected to have to postpone as many of the games as they've had to. And also the idea of, you know, short attendances in Canadian markets has to be keeping Gary Bettman up at night, doesn't it, Sean?
Yeah, it's Omicron is definitely having an impact, and it's kind of the big one right off the bat. Obviously, rescheduling games is big, but one of the biggest things right off the bat is those games that we see, I think it was like January 4th or 5th, and there was the Toronto-Edmonton game. With no fans, and a game like that, having a game like that with zero fans represents probably roughly $5 million US that would go to the HRR number. And back on December 5th or 6th at the Board of Governors meetings, when the league projects, hey, we'll be at $5.2 billion for HRR, and we'll still be able to get the cap to go up $1 million and everything like that. They weren't really planning on missing out on $5 million chunks here and there. And so those things just start to add up. And even the games rescheduled that they're going to get back in the United States have a bit of an impact, just because, say, you're an American team that the New Year's Eve game is usually one of your biggest selling nights of the year. And it's some Canadian teams as well. And so you'll get that game back and maybe even the ticket sales on it, but you're not getting nearly as many beers and food and beverage and merch sales on a Tuesday night in February like we're going to have now. So Omicron is having a huge impact on it, and it's still like the month of January isn't really going to change as much because these new regulations don't go in place till after the All-Star game. But the league is obviously hoping and looking at what's happened with the NFL and the NBA, where not testing asymptomatic players has led to a much smoother landing, I guess we'll call it.
Yeah, it's the cross-border travel is, you know, the NBA does have the Raptors, but it's one team, not seven, right? So it does factor in a lot more. And you know, I guess the thing for the NHL is the Canadian teams are just such big revenue drivers, right? So that's in the end going to affect hockey-related revenue to a significant extent.
100%. Yeah, it's there's not just the Canadian teams on average and obviously have much higher attendance than the American teams, and you have higher spending at the games themselves, and then you have the Canadian TV. It's not going to really touched by this, but it's just all those factors that show how important the Canadian teams are to the NHL revenue. And as this kind of hits the Canadian teams, it's like I was talking to someone the other day from a team that is a revenue sharing team, and they were talking about how everyone may laugh or someone may point at the Maple Leafs for having to play a game without fans, but really that's hurting the teams in the bottom 10 from revenue, because they're now not getting that revenue. They're missing out. The Arizona Coyotes and Florida Panthers, ironically enough, they miss out when the Toronto Maple Leafs don't play without fans. It's kind of a reality I don't think a lot of people remember about this.
Yeah, revenue sharing. I could still remember some of the days back in Toronto with how upset they were that revenue sharing was coming in, but part of the CBA and how it all works. Sean Shapiro, our guest, covering the business of hockey at The Athletic. Another really interesting thing you wrote about, Sean, alongside Ryan Clark, practice facilities in the NHL and how they could become or are becoming a big deciding factor in free agents. Here in Vancouver, they do not have a big-time practice facility. It's been the ongoing thing that they're continuously looking for an area, but with real estate the way that it is in Vancouver, you know, not exactly the easiest thing to do. But, you know, how is this, you know, multi-million-dollar massive practice facility, starting to really change the way players think about their next destination?
Yeah, it's obviously at the end of the day, money and term, and those are still going to be number one and two for players and everything like that. But as you start to go down the checklist of things that players look at when they start considering a destination, and it's going to be how they're treated and how they live on a daily basis definitely comes into play. And we always hear one of the kind of cliches we always hear from agents is like, oh, you want to go to a place that has strong ownership. And I've talked to people, players and agents before who have pointed to the state of the practice facility or the facilities, whether it's at the rink or how the players are treated, is kind of a direct reflection of ownership. And that's kind of a tangible way to kind of find that, why a good owner that's not just spending to the cap, it's spending on the other things. And so it's something that is definitely has gone from kind of like a luxury to a point of entry almost for teams, where the Seattle Kraken, when they come in right away, one of the first things they do is they build multi-million-dollar facility. The Vegas Golden Knights, obviously, when they came in, and you start to look across the league where it's kind of, you build this or you get left behind. I've talked to a bunch of agents now who, it's easier to point to the places where it isn't as opposed to where it is. And you start to get, I don't want to say red flags, but it becomes something where you start to think a little bit about as a player of, is this, how are they going to treat me? How is it going to be here? So it's definitely, players are starting to expect that luxury basically. Mm-hmm. And if you're not providing it with a practice facility or something that's part of the arena itself, obviously there's different ways to do it, but if you're not providing that, players are noticing. And I think my favorite story that Ryan and I in that story was the fact that there was one team in the bubble who their executives basically, after the players played a game in the Oilers locker room, they kind of asked the league to move them to the Oil Kings room because it was a little bit more closer to home for them. And that's just, it's kind of, they were kind of embarrassed that, that their players saw what it was like in another room. And so it definitely is something players notice.
You know, it's just another reason for us Canadian hockey fans to be like, oh, see, that nobody wants to play in Canada, right? You know, we're always worried about taxes and things like this. And now you look at the just another reason, you know, from your experience with players, you know, how much does the tax thing come into mind when a player is thinking about their next contract? We know, you know, Texas and Florida, the no income tax thing. How much of a benefit really is that for players?
It's definitely something players take into account. It's something where we look at what one of the reasons it's impossible to ignore where Tampa is located. When we look at, obviously they've gotten players to buy in and take less money as they've done this cap gymnastics. But another part of that is the money Steven Stamkos makes in Florida is much more than a similar salary in, say, California or Canada or anything along those lines. So it definitely comes into play, and it's definitely a benefit for those teams in the Florida and in Texas, and even I'm actually surprised we don't see it get flexed as much, because Tennessee doesn't have state income tax either. I'm actually surprised we don't see the Predators kind of try to flex it a little bit more. But so it comes into play. It makes the true value of a contract more, and especially for players who are kind of looking, if a guy's looking to win, or if a guy's like, hey, I'm going trying to go to this place to win, obviously that's one thing. But if a guy is purely looking at money, at the money value of a contract and weighing options, at the end of the day, you're going to make way more money on a similar contract by going to a team in Florida at the end of the day. And it's something that I think we'll see more and more of with the Panthers as they've been obviously a great team but this year. But I think we'll see kind of them be able to push that a little bit more as they try to kind of emulate what's happened in the other team in their state.
I know we all have our takes about All-Star games and things of that nature. Personally, like, I still get nostalgic love for the skills competition every time it comes around. But with all the postponements and everything that's happened, I am kind of surprised that the NHL is still pushing forward with the All-Star game. Is it really that big of an event for its corporate sponsors?
It is for the corporate sponsors. I mean, the game itself has clearly lost a lot of luster. I mean, I remember watching it as a kid, and it was a big deal and everything like that. And now the skills competition is fun, but other than that, for me, the game itself is kind of ho hum. But from the corporate sponsors and the TV partners, it is a big deal. The NHL, I can't remember whether it's Discover or Honda or whatever one they have now sponsoring as the All-Star game, pays a pretty big amount of money to be the presenting sponsor for the All-Star game. There's a lot of other, there's ESPN was the TV partner. ESPN really wanted the All-Star game. So there's this money. There's basically, the league is not in a spot right now where it's interested in having to give money back to people. The main reason we even have helmet ads now was because teams had to do make goods and basically get the first year of helmet ads last year was essentially to make up lost money to sponsors. And now they're actually worth money. But the main reason where we have that is because the league didn't really want to find ways to not have to give back money. So that's why the All-Star game is happening. At the end of the day, it's follow the money thing. And it would have been, the fact the players are not going to the Olympics obviously makes it, I think, feasible, I guess, is the right word. I don't know if it passes the smell test, but it's still something that's now possible because they're not going to the Olympics. But if they had still been pushing through with the Olympics and these postponements and everything like that, the All-Star game would have been maybe then. I think the league would have lost the All-Star game if they had gone to the Olympics.
It's Canuck Central. Sean Shapiro joining us here on the show. And an interesting development in the women's game, Sean. The Premier Hockey Federation getting a $25 million commitment from its board of governors in direct payment and benefits. And, you know, we know the PHW, the PWHPA and Premier Hockey Federation have had their situation, and you have these two leagues, and everybody wants to see it come together and have one women's league that can really start to flourish in maybe a way that we've seen with the WNBA or even the NWSL. But this does, I mean, just reading the headline, it's, you know, my first takeaway is like, wow, this has to be a pretty significant moment for the women's game. Am I right in that assessment?
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, one of the things that's obviously missing from women's hockey, and it's the reason the PWHPA even formed in the first place, was the search for the quest for the livable wage, where the quest for a livable wage and full health insurance and all of these things. And so this is a big step that the PHF, formerly the NWHL, is taking. And the other thing that it can't be ignored, because this is a big part of the story. The PHF, at the end of the day, they're trying to position themselves right now to be that one league, because everyone points out, hey, we need one league. We can't have two competing leagues. And the PHF's play here by this, and it's there's nothing wrong with it at all, but the point is, if you're going to get the best players in the world back to your league, you need to be able to pay the best players in the world like they're the best players in the world. And that's really at the heart of this kind of this plan. It's to try to bolster the PHF to be that spot. It's obviously good for women's hockey to see the commitment of to raise the salary cap to $750K next year. And that's definitely a step in the right direction. And it's going to be interesting to see how the PWHPA kind of reacts and how their members react. Obviously a lot of them are in the middle of prepping for the Olympics. So I think kind of one of the other thoughts of the PHF right now was kind of put this in people's brains, get the idea going, and then after these players finish playing at the Olympics, where they're kind of the height of their sport, and they stop and look and realize that they don't really have a league to go back to, and we don't really have a structure right now, maybe the PHF starts to look a lot more attractive. So it's good for women's hockey that we're seeing this money committed. It's also going to be really interesting to see how this all goes, because obviously the women's hockey landscape has been, it can be very confusing. It can be very confusing to anyone who's trying to jump into it right away, because there's been a lot of arguments and disagreements and everything like that. So we will, it's a lot to get into.
Yeah. We'll have to wait and see. And, you know, I know the appetite is there when we've seen it with whether it's world championships or the Olympics. When we see that best on best, especially between America and Canada, there's always the appetite there. But from the club level, it just hasn't happened yet. Thanks so much for this today, Sean. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There is Sean Shapiro of The Athletic covering the business of the NHL. And a lot of really interesting things happening around the league. You know, when you think about the Canucks salary cap situation and you wonder if the squeeze will continue to be on with the salary cap for an extended period of time, how that affects Vancouver, how it affects the league in general, how it affects their ability to keep JT Miller and Bo Horvat, is that something they would like to do? These are all valid questions to be having as all of these games get postponed. So I know, as a texter mentions on the Dunbar Lumber text line, love how the NHL will impose all of these restrictions due to COVID, yet has zero issue putting players from 30 teams on the ice at the same time for an all-star game. And I get it. I do. But money rules the day. In the same way that the Canucks postponed that January 8th game against the Ottawa Senators, and now it's been moved to April 21st, I believe, and will be the second half of a back-to-back, and end up being a 3-4 for what might be a very crucial stretch of the Canucks season should they continue to be in a playoff chase at that point. It comes down to the dollars and cents of it. And it's not just the owner. It's the league as well. The league cannot afford to have its Canadian teams playing a bunch of games with no fans. The league can't afford that. The league can't afford to have the Maple Leafs playing in front of zero people. Often. Same goes for the Canucks, the Oilers, the Flames, Montreal. The big Canadian markets drive revenue across the board. There are teams that count on the revenue sharing checks of the Maple Leafs and the New York Rangers of the world. And now all of a sudden, they're not going to get those because the Maple Leafs aren't going to be the huge revenue driver that they normally are. It affects everything about the league. So, yes, there is an element of every local owner would love to have their fans in the building and concessions open and all those things to make that sort of a gate and that money to pay for the hockey team that costs them just in salary $80 million a year. But it goes deeper than that. And the league, it's really important to the league to have these revenue-driving events right now. And that's why they're so committed to the All-Star game. I know you don't like it. I don't love it either. You're probably not going to watch it. I probably won't watch it. I'll tune in for the skills comp. I always love the skills comp. But the game itself? I can't remember the last one I watched. But the league has to keep big revenue drivers going because they don't want, and players don't want, you hear Brad Marchand still today on Twitter complaining about escrow. Players don't want this to go on forever. The players want this as much as the owners do because they know it drives hockey-related revenue, which on the back end affects them and how much money they're making and paying into escrow. So know that when you're blaming the Canucks' losses on whomever it is you're blaming it on. It's Dan Riccio, Canucks Central. We will close it out. We'll listen back on our interview with Ian McIntyre and some of hockey's most awkward media moments. We know Leon Draisaitl. We remember Leon Draisaitl from this week. But what are some of those that are most memorable for me and you? We can have some fun with it. We've got the audio. We'll play it back, reminisce about some of those moments next. It's Canucks Central on Sportsnet 650.